history friends, patrons, PhD pals, all to the third installment of Poland is Not Yet Lost. Last time we examined how it was that Augustus II, the King of Poland, and Peter, the Tsar of Russia, came to identify with one another over the idea of a war with Sweden. Anyone who's listened to our remastered episodes on the Great Northern War will know where all of this is headed, but the complex details, the intrigues, and of course the diplomacy are all coming under closer examination here than we've ever given them before. And as you've probably gathered by now, in order to tell the story of any country or state or people, you also have to consider its neighbours, its allies, and its enemies in order to tell it. For those of you looking for an exclusive Polish experience, so for example like a year-by-year telling of exactly what was going on in every single Polish province, not sure exactly why you expected such a thing from me. But suffice to say, in time we will dive into more detail on Poland-Lithuania in the 18th century. But for now, it's important to explain how that Commonwealth became trapped, thanks to the ambitions and machinations of its Saxon king in the Great Northern War. To tell this story, we pick up where we left off last time 2 weeks ago, with that disgruntled Livonian nobleman, Johann Reinhold von Patkel, and the ambitions he had to free his comrades from the oppressive policies of the Swedish crown. These ambitions led him first into the confidence of Augustus II of Poland, who Patkel wished to welcome to Livonia as his new master, and then, as we saw last time, to the Tsar's court in Moscow, where a secret Polish delegation tasked with formalizing Russia's commitment to a war with Sweden had arrived. As we also learned at the end of the last episode, the Polish delegation were watched with unease by a Swedish delegation, who wanted at all costs to preserve peace between the Empire of Sweden and that of Russia. Let's see how this fascinating situation played itself out then, as we take you to early October 1699. Tsar Peter was faced with several quandaries when he returned from his visit to the Russian Black Sea Fleet in October 1699. On paper, nothing had been agreed since Peter's previous visit the year before with Augustus, when the startling offer to parcel up the Baltic and take pieces of Sweden's empire as they saw fit was first posed by the newly installed Polish king. In the years before, Peter had been obsessed with the idea of forming a coalition against the Ottomans, which could be used to wage a continued war after the Holy League's example. The Holy League had been formally waging such a war against the heathen Turk since the early 1680s, when the last siege of Vienna proved a pivotal turning point in the relations between East and West. The relief of that siege, famously conducted under the stunning authority of King Augustus's predecessor, Jan Sobieski, seemed to spur both the Poles and the Austrians onward. In 1684, Venice joined what became known now as the Holy League, and this was turned against the Ottoman Empire with its full force over the subsequent years. Russia partook in this rush for Turkish spoils only from the mid-1690s, but the results had brought her people some acclaim. Seeing the end goal of this intervention, as the Russian expansion to the Black Sea and her establishment there with a reinforced military naval base, Peter determined, through the course of his great embassy throughout Europe, to learn all that he could about naval warfare, construction and technology, and to court the states whose capitals he visited with the idea of joining Russia in a Western alliance against the suffering Turks. Seeing perhaps the elements of Russian self-interest in this plan, rather than the outright crusade as it was generally portrayed, Peter returned home mostly disappointed. But before he had reached Moscow, he passed through Poland and met with its new king. Augustus owed much to his warmly friendly, mysteriously exotic and strikingly tall new Russian friend, as Russian pressure on the Polish frontiers had convinced many border Commonwealth nobles to vote for the candidate of least resistance, that being Augustus II. Thanks to Peter's strategic inclinations, this meant any candidate who was not French, and so Augustus ascended to the Polish throne with significant help from Augustus's own Saxon soldiery, who essentially installed him there before the French candidate could arrive. By the time the two rulers met in July 1698, then, Peter had been largely disappointed by his efforts to mobilise Western opinion and support, and he was thus more susceptible to the idea of war in a different direction than he would have been even a few months before. A crusade against the Muslim Turks in the name of acquiring a Black Sea port was one thing, but quite another was the notion that Peter could be the one to reclaim the old Baltic Russian territories lost to Gustavus Adolphus in the early 17th century. Success in the Baltic would provide Russia and its Tsar with a great deal of prestige, and the resulting occupation of these Baltic provinces, named Livonia in this era, just to make things less complicated, would also give a much-needed boost to Moscow's coffers. This was the irresistible deal that Augustus presented to Peter when they met face to face, adding the important detail that not only would the Danes be brought on side, but that Sweden's teenage monarch lacked the resolve or experience to deal with the three-pronged threat, so their triple offensive would be met with leagues of success. Paradoxically, though, while the King of Poland wanted Peter's help, he didn't want him to stick around. Livonia, as per Augustus's plans, was to become essentially either a Saxon fief or a carrot which he could use to bribe the recalcitrant Commonwealth nobles. Under no circumstances was it to become a purely Russian estate. It was in line with this caveat that Augustus had sent the very man who had persuaded him of the genius of this design, the aforementioned disgruntled nobleman, Johann Reinhold von Patkel, to Moscow to oversee these secret negotiations and ensure that Peter was not promised any more than Augustus wanted to give. Patkel had proved essential in persuading Augustus of the flawlessness of his scheme. Where Augustus worried that the Western powers would intervene, Patkel argued that the Netherlands, the British, Austria and France would make loud noises about their trade, but would probably do nothing. Where Augustus was concerned that Peter's lack of an experienced and loyal army would stand against the joint efforts, particularly in Riga, where the brunt of the attack was to be focused, Patkel provided the following striking opinion. Russian infantry would be most serviceable for working in the trenches and for receiving the enemy's shots, while the troops of Augustus could be preserved and used for covering the approaches. This view was a polite way of Patkel, and therefore Augustus, blessing the idea that these Russian recruits would serve as little more than cannon fodder to the Swedes, while Augustus's more experienced Saxon troops, when the Swedes ran out of ammunition or endurance or whatever, would get the actual job done. Augustus's concerns about Russian reliance came from the known fact that Peter had had much trouble with his army at the time, in that he had waged a trying campaign of intimidation and torture against the old, supposedly elite, Moscow Guard, known as the Streltsy. Peter's relationship with the Streltsy was similar to that of later Roman emperors with their Praetorian Guard, except that in Peter's estimation, the Streltsy had not been an effective fighting force since Ivan the Terrible's era in the mid-16th century. Determined to remove them and their influence as a fifth column in the modernizing state that he was attempting to build, Peter was ruthless in his persecution of this old medieval force. The Streltsy proved resistant, though, and Peter was often forced to rely on them so long as he lacked the kind of gigantic standing armies for which Russia would later be known. Incidentally, it was this reluctant reliance on elements of the Streltsy which caused Peter to cut his great embassy short. Of further interest, such events were connected to the recent Polish election, as the Streltsy regiments had been ordered to the Polish border as the election dragged on. When they were about to return home to Moscow, having successfully pressured the Commonwealth to vote for Augustus, these units of Streltsy rebelled against the Tsar's authority, and they seemed to be threatening Moscow itself. Alarmed at the prospect of losing his rule to these traitors, Peter made haste for home after visiting Vienna, but he was soon informed that the Streltsy had been put down with customary brutality. By the time he made it home in September 1698, then, Peter was in no mood to play nice. In his efforts to break the back of the Streltsy, Peter effectively broke the back of Russia's ability to project its own power. To wage a war, he would have to raise a brand new army, which he would dutifully do when the time came, but this series of events helps to explain the strange contradiction inherent in Augustus's behavior. Because while he wished to see his new Russian friend take the field in support, he didn't put much stock in Peter's armies as a fighting force, even while he feared that a lucky strike could see them masters of the Baltic regions, denying that region to Augustus's family in the process. As was the case between 1698 to 99, Johann von Patkull had some advice for his new Saxon king on how to deal with this conundrum. He said, "It would be absolutely necessary to bind the hands of the Tsar in such a way that he should not eat before our eyes the piece roasted for us. That is, he should not get hold of Livonia and should restrict his attack on Narva, for in that case he could threaten the centre of Livonia and take Dorpat, Reval, and the whole of Estonia almost before it could be known in Warsaw." Armed with such advice, Augustus elected to simply send this strong-minded Livonian gentleman along with the secret delegation to Moscow, incognito, as seemed to be the tradition of the day. Since both the Polish king and his potential subject saw eye to eye on this issue, Augustus believed that persuading or influencing the Tsar would not be too difficult a task. The end goal drove him on either way, and that's where our story has gotten to so far. We saw last time that Augustus's surprisingly grand ambitions belied his diminutive powers as King of Poland. By 1699, Polish kings could not wage war independently of the Sejm's approval, nor could they sign treaties or even pass financial legislation without the approval of the nobles. By passing such landmines, Augustus endeavoured instead to wage war, not as Augustus II, the King of Poland, but as Frederick Augustus, the Elector of Saxony. This important distinction also underlines his plans for Livonia, because this was not a straightforward war of conquest against Livonia in Poland's name. Instead, it should be seen as a ploy on Augustus's part for some dynastic prestige and expansion. By capturing Livonia for his Saxon electorate and redefining his rule over it in any way he wished, Augustus could choose between establishing himself as the King of Livonia or using that same territory to coerce the tiresome Commonwealth magnates to see things his way. Ironically, Patkull, the very individual who proposed the war to Augustus and promised his countrymen's support for a new Polish master, had no intention of blindly adhering to new and difficult Saxon laws himself. What Patkull really wanted was a weak, decentralized power to be controlling Livonia, since it was through such an arrangement that he expected to derive the most independence and advantages. Had he known the full extent of Augustus's plan, he may not have proved so eager to serve him. But regardless of who knew what and who planned what, it is remarkable to denote the high-minded plans in Augustus's arsenal. While technically Poland-Lithuania was not a member of the looming coalition war, subsequent events would demonstrate the impossibility of isolating Augustus's Saxon titles from his Polish crown. These facts speak to the idea that Poland was by no means the Russian puppet or the ineffectual actor in international relations by the turn of the century, that the balance of power was firmly in Augustus's hands by this point, in his mind at least, makes it all the more incredible to see his realm's rapid decline and eventual subservience to Russian control in the subsequent decades. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Back in Moscow, though, and as the Swedish delegation looked nervously at the suspicious Polish guests of the Tsar, they sought to establish the same cordial relations enjoyed by the previous king, Charles the 11th. It was a custom of the era to renegotiate treaties and confirm old agreements with the death of one ruler and the ascension of the new. It just so happened that Patkull accompanied a Commonwealth delegation aiming at precisely the opposite agreement to the Swedes. Operating in utter secrecy, the Commonwealth delegates would meet with Peter in his private quarters, who was accompanied only by his favourite and an interpreter. Peter, quite unlike his Saxon friend, did not need the support of anyone to make war. He could choose to do so with as much legislative ease as he would choose to get out of bed in the morning. The Swedish delegation certainly noticed that something ill was in the air, but they were all smiles and nodding heads when they met publicly with the Tsar and his ministers in the Russian Foreign Office. Not only were new agreements promised by the Swedes, more favourable to Russian commerce than the previous ones, but much apologies and gifts were given to make up for the Tsar's uncomfortable experience during his great embassy's visit to Riga in 1697. The frosty reception Peter had received at that Swedish bastion in the Baltic in 1697 had much to do with Peter's efforts to sketch and detail the Swedish defences and weaknesses while attempting to remain cast as just a humble retainer for the wider Russian embassy. This freakishly tall, dark-haired and totally defiant spy had yelled abuse at a Swedish soldier who had held him at gunpoint and ordered him off of Riga's walls, whereupon Peter had flown into a rage and terrorized the soldier into nearly firing his weapon. When the soldier had learned the true identity of the man he had nearly shot dead, since, don't forget, Tsar Peter was incognito all this time, he supposedly fainted and thereafter threw himself at the governor of Riga's mercy. This governor was told by Peter not to punish the soldier for simply doing his job, since by then the Tsar had calmed down, but the damage had apparently been done nonetheless. We can imagine then that this new Swedish embassy was eager to get back into Peter's good graces in the autumn of 1699, and certainly there was not much to like in the prevailing rumours which suggested that the Tsar was making common cause with Sweden's enemies. To drive home the point that their friendship was valuable and their teenage king more than capable of defending his realm, the Swedes gifted Peter a full-length portrait of Charles XII, the new king, on horseback, staring defiantly at the painter. Peter received the Swedes with much honour, and he proclaimed his eager intentions to preserve peace and to make further treaties into the future. To salve his own conscience, Peter's biographer noted that he avoided kissing the cross at the ceremony to mark the signing of the treaties of friendship with Sweden, since at this stage, Peter would have known full well what he was going to do quite soon. When the Swedes murmured at this strange behaviour, Peter assured them that he refrained from kissing crosses in these circumstances, as he had made oaths to uphold all treaties at the time of his coronation, and he had kissed the cross then. So it seemed that Peter had an answer for everything, and the deception only continued when he received the Swedes for the last time on the 24th of November, 1699. It was there that a letter from Charles XII of Sweden declared his intention to maintain peace and amity between Sweden and Russia, to which Peter declared himself more than pleased. Only 3 days later, once the Swedes had left, Patkul and the other Commonwealth agents met again with the Tsar, this time calling in the Danish representative, who had already formalised his treaty of alliance with Saxony, in secrecy. Here, Peter pledged himself to attack Sweden, if possible in April 1700, in other words, the following spring. Yet Peter was careful to make his attack contingent on first achieving peace with the Ottoman Empire. He would only make war on Sweden, in other words, if that troublesome war with the Turks could first be resolved. A Russian agent had sailed with much pomp and impact to Constantinople in the spring of 1699 to bring about this very peace, but Peter wanted to be sure that he'd covered all his bases before acting. The Tsar refrained from making the date of the attack part of the final elements of the offensive alliance, but he did sign the treaty anyway on the 27th of November 1699, providing in the process the most concrete step yet towards a military confrontation with Sweden. In return, the Commonwealth delegates promised Peter control over Ingria and Karelia, but they were careful to avoid talking much about Livonia in general. Remaining vague was the order of the day in Patkul's mind, and he ensured that Peter had been promised nothing where that region was concerned. Karelia and Ingria were two pieces of the Baltic pie further north of Livonia, and well out of the way of any Russian ambitions, so Augustus and Patkul believed. Karelia is in the modern-day eastern portion of Finland, while Ingria is directly to the south of modern-day St. Petersburg. Such commitments on the part of the Commonwealth delegation effectively pledged the region around the northern Baltic to Peter, and it would enable him in time to build his Baltic capital when the time came. 2 weeks after this agreement, so mid-December 1699, Patkul and the other members of the delegation left Moscow and returned home. Augustus's incredible play for regional supremacy seemed complete. At a stroke, he had helped to engineer not only an offensive alliance against his enemy, but but he also ensured that the spoils of war would fall totally to his dynasty. There was no suggestion at this stage that Augustus would be faced either with the intervention of the Commonwealth itself or with a difficult campaign that had the potential to end in defeat. Augustus wasn't considering defeat at this point. Confidence seemed to be in plentiful supply in the Saxon court, for Augustus didn't even wait either for his Russian or his Danish allies to take part. In February 1700, 14,000 Saxon soldiers invaded Livonia and made for Riga without making any formal declaration of war on Sweden. In the subsequent course of events, the Swedes counterattacked and scattered the approaching Saxons, killing their commander in the process. When the Tsar learned of this course of events, Peter exclaimed his disgust at Augustus's decision not to lead his army in person, as the Russian, and indeed Swedish monarchs were soon to do, and had done in the past. The defeat of Augustus's initial aims suggested that all would not be plain sailing, and that Sweden's integrity had been grossly underestimated. Further, Peter was aghast that Augustus acted before either liaising with the planned Russian support, or even consulting him. Worse news was still to come for the anti-Swedish League, though, when the Danish attack on the Duke of Holstein-Gottorp also failed to ignite. Though marching with 16,000 men and armed to the teeth and placing the town of Tønning under siege, the Danes were vulnerable to a surprise assault from the sea, which was launched by the young King of Sweden in April 1700, as Copenhagen itself was suddenly placed under threat. With English and Dutch pressure, Denmark sued for peace in August 1700, but for the first half of the year, with his Saxon and Danish allies putting on none too inspiring performances, Peter must have felt the pinch to act before it was too late, and the anti-Swedish League disintegrated before it could even take root. As we saw, though, Peter's hands were tied, as he said to his premier, "It is a pity, but there is nothing to be done. I have not heard from Constantinople." Despite the urging of Augustus and Frederick IV of Denmark, Peter would not act until his agent in Constantinople had assured him of the Ottoman intentions for peace. Yet, as the year 1700 progressed, it appeared as though the Turks intended to renew the war against Russia with renewed aggression when the campaigning season resumed. Such rumours of an Ottoman attack compelled Peter, incredibly, to try and cozy up to Sweden and present himself as the neutral friend which Stockholm could count on, just as the Baltic seemed to be arming against Sweden and its young king. As spring 1700 progressed, Peter even proposed sending an embassy to Stockholm to demonstrate his good intentions. This gesture was picked up by the resident Swedish envoy in Moscow and heartily approved of. When Peter returned from visiting his gradually growing army in the field, the deception grew to ridiculous levels. Meeting with the Swedish envoy, Peter showed him the contents of a letter which the envoy's daughter had shared with the Tsar when he visited the military town in the previous weeks. The letter had been sent to the Swedish envoy's daughter by that envoy's wife, and within it, Peter noted, his wife declared her belief that Russia was soon to attack Sweden in Livonia. The Swedish envoy, who had been completely oblivious as to the secret negotiations that were going on right under his nose between his wife and daughter, was horrified at the notion that his family, and female members of his family no less, could discuss such weighted topics with such reckless abandon, and he was all the more horrified when he learned that his daughter, who was respected in the Tsar's court, had approached the Tsar in tears at the suggestion that Russia and Sweden were soon to be at war. "I could hardly calm your daughter. She was crying so bitterly," the sly Tsar said to the Swedish envoy. With the Swedish envoy now likely speechless, Peter upped the ante with some guilt bombs, saying, "You cannot think that I would begin an unjust war against the King of Sweden and break an eternal peace which I have promised to just preserve." At the incredulous response from the Swedish envoy and his retinue, Peter insisted that if affairs did progress to a certain point and Riga was captured by the King of Poland, "I will tear it from his hands." So convincing and sincere did the Tsar seem, making the promises and feigning the hurt feelings while also affectionately hugging and patting the Swedish envoy on the back that this same envoy wrote home to Stockholm of Russia's unremitting loyalty to Sweden in the face of the latest catastrophe. "The strategic situation may be grave," the envoy said, "but at the very least, Russia would never wage war against its Swedish friends." Of course, Peter's promises and pledges were meant to disarm and ease the concerns of the Swedes, who can't have been ignorant of the active rearming afoot in Russia. Since the previous December, Peter had set to work building, training and equipping his new army for use in the coming war with Sweden. The stark differences between the Tsar and his Polish neighbour were never as stark as when both prepared for war. Where Augustus would have to rely on his nobles for the funds and soldiers, Peter merely pushed a new civil order through, which demanded that landowners, be they secular or religious, would have to send Peter's budding army one recruit for every portion of land that they owned. This largely serf army was then trained and led by some of the best Western military minds that Peter could get his hands on, including some contacts which he had made during his great embassy of a few years before. By the time he went to war, virtually all of the regimental commanders would hail from places outside Russia, while the overall command of the army fell to the few remaining Russian generals capable of leadership. Russian serfs were dressed in the German fashion, as Peter took much inspiration from Frederick III, soon to be crowned king in Prussia. Artillery was provided, incredible as it may seem, by the King of Sweden, since a large supply of over 300 guns had been shipped to Russia in the previous years, in the name of the Russo-Swedish friendship and trust, as much as the symbolic promise made by the Tsar to use these cannons against those infidel Turks. Such promises were conveniently forgotten now, as Peter arranged the Swedish guns for use against their manufacturers. Having an army was all well and good, but Peter refused to use it or make any plays against Sweden until peace with the Ottomans was assured. The clock ticked by as Augustus II and Frederick IV of Denmark sweated under the intense Swedish pressure. By late June 1700, it seemed inevitable that Denmark would be forced from the war, but still, no word had come from Russia about its plans for war, since no word had come from Constantinople about Ottoman plans for peace. This incredibly tense state of affairs provoked Augustus to send a Saxon envoy, Major General Baron Langen, to Moscow in July. Augustus was by this stage with his army before Riga, and he begged Peter to intervene with haste. Langen recorded Peter's bind on the 15th of July, writing that, "The Tsar sent his ministers out of the room, and with tears in his eyes, said to me in broken Dutch how grieved he was at the delay in concluding a peace with Turkey. He said that he had ordered his ambassador to conclude a peace or a truce in the quickest possible time, even to his own loss, in order to have his hands free to aid his allies with all of his forces." Incidentally, by the time this letter was written in the middle of July, the much longed for peace between Russia and the Ottomans had been reached. The Russian ambassador in question had struck gold, and on the 3rd of July, 1700, he acquired a commitment from the Turks to respect peace between their two empires for a period of at least 30 years. This messenger arrived 36 days later in Moscow on the 8th of August, at last putting all concerned, save for the King of Sweden of course, out of their misery. Liberated from his strategic concerns, Peter wasted barely seconds in committing his about-face. The very evening that the news had been received, the peace with Turkey was celebrated with much pomp and, of course, fireworks, which so fascinated Tsar Peter. On the next morning, the 9th of August, 1700, Peter formally declared war on Sweden in the old custom of the Muscovite Tsars from the bedchamber in the Kremlin. The official notice went out, and the proclamation was read to a stunned Russian populace. The declaration went, "The great Tsar has directed that for the many wrongs of the Swedish king, and especially because during the Tsar's journey through Riga he suffered obstacles and unpleasantness at the hands of the people of Riga, his soldiers shall march in war on the Swedish towns in the provinces of Ingria and Karelia, which by the grace of God and according to law have always belonged to Russia and were lost during the time of troubles." That very day, in a private letter to his co-conspirator, Augustus II, Peter wrote about the latest developments and exclaimed, "We hope, by the help of God, that your majesty will not see other than profit." This exclamation, from Tsar to Elector King, would prove especially poignant in the years to come. While in 1700 it seemed as though Russia was destined to fulfil its role as a true ally first of the Saxons and by proxy of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, it seemed impossible to imagine that in a few catastrophic years these two friends and equals would see their positions utterly changed. This war, which Peter had just pledged his empire to in support of his flagging Danish ally and the ambitious Saxon elector, was the Great Northern War. It would represent at its core the metaphorical passing of the torch from Sweden to Russia, as Peter realized his ambitions to bring his empire into the modern world. In order to achieve such an end, a terrible consequence, impossible to foresee in Augustus's court in 1700, was the total destruction of the Commonwealth's independence. Where he had begun the war as a firm ally of Tsar Peter, he would end the Great Northern War as a de facto vassal of Russia's towering ambitions. Where they had begun the war as equals, Augustus's decision to make war at all ensured that never again in the history of the two peoples would the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth be permitted to act without consultation with its supreme Russian neighbour. Almost without realising it, without, it seemed, any expectation that the war would lead to his kingdom's rapid degeneration and eventual death on the world stage, Augustus II, the King of Poland, had unwittingly committed his ambitions to the dice of fate, and in the process, he had committed his kingdom, this republic, this commonwealth, to a century and more of agony. Next time, we'll see how this process truly began, and how Augustus's fatal miscalculations about both friend and foe alike already showed signs of haunting him for the duration of his troubled reign. I hope you'll join me for that, but until then, I've been Zach, and this has been When Diplomacy Fails and Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Thanks so much for supporting this show, guys. I really, really appreciate it, especially now as the PhD is heating up in intensity and I need all the monies I can get. You're the best, and I'll be seeing you all